Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Sargon. Sarah, how are you?
I've come back inside.
Good to have you back inside with us. And we are also joined today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you?
Very well, thank you. But also very glad to be inside. It's a wet and nippy day in Cape Town today. But good to be joining both of you.
Yes, Johannesburg is a little bit chilly, but not too bad. Right. Just an apology. I do have my camera / cell phone balanced rather precariously upon a microphone stand here. So if it falls off during the show, my apologies. But hopefully that won't happen. Anyway, let's get into the news of today. And the first thing we're going to talk a little bit about is President Ramaphosa's letter. He often sends out a letter on Mondays, just sort of addressing a topic that's on his mind. And this week's newsletter tries to kind of frame the recently passed Public Procurement Act as fixing the problems identified in the Zondo Commission report. But I think that's not really the whole story. So he kind of talks up the Public Procurement Act, saying that it will eliminate procurement problems identified by Chief Justice Raymond Zondo in the report of the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture. This law eliminates the problems identified by Chief Justice Zondo, fragmentation in procurement laws, by creating a cohesive regulatory framework. Zondo had described corruption in procurement as the quote-unquote centerpiece of state capture. Ramaphosa says that the Act establishes a Public Procurement Office in National Treasury. The office will put in place measures to ensure the integrity of the procurement process. He said the office must promote standardization in procurement and modernize the system through technology and innovation. All right, sounds good. But he's leaving out something from the Zondo Commission report that is pretty glaring, and that is the point Zondo made about preferential procurement, racial preference, and value for money. The Zondo Commission was very clear that when the state has to choose between, you know, sort of favoring a race group through like BEE laws or preferential procurement laws, or ensuring value for money, i.e. that the poor South Africans who are the majority beneficiaries of state expenditure get good services, that it should prioritize at all times value for money. And this seems to be completely absent from Ramaphosa's comments on the Public Procurement Act. In fact, what he neglects to mention is that the Public Procurement Act makes some of these things worse and, in fact, entrenches some of the public procurement legislation. Sarah, what do you make of this?
This is a bit of old-fashioned Ramaphosa making out something to be something it's not, and invariably doing so because it's actually to the detriment of the broader population of South Africa. I mean, at the end of the day, you really want a couple of things from procurement. You want value for money, you want competence of the service providers, and you do not want to be paying essentially a BEE premium on every contract that goes through the public sector. And this is now essentially going onto steroids, because not only are all those negatives still in place, but they've been enhanced by the fact that essentially the government can stymie an applicant for a tender before they've even put their tender in, by virtue of not complying with BEE laws, BEE requirements. And the minute you, and I think this is what Zondo recognized essentially, the minute you try to socially engineer or society or make it, or socially, or do it even worse than it's been done at present, it is by its very nature becomes more open to corruption. It doesn't matter what so-called safeguards you put in place. But more than that, it's, if you want economic growth, surely you do not want to make things artificially more expensive, which ultimately ends up being passed on to the consumer. I mean, one could, you know, talk about the sort of potential effects at length, but that's the essence of what Ramaphosa is trying to do. And while it may serve the groups that support him and support BEE and tries to recapture some of the middle class, despite everything else, what Zondo basically said in a nutshell was that approach is unconstitutional. So it's so dishonest that I'm kind of wondering, you know, what it does for the GNU, for those parties to the GNU that would oppose it for exactly the reasons that it is unconstitutional and contradicts what Zondo found. So I don't think this does Cyril Ramaphosa any good at all.
So it's kind of interesting, this point Zondo makes about value for money, is that I don't think I've seen any serious kind of counterpoint or argument from proponents of BE against it, because I think it's a really important way to frame the whole thing, which is that when you have money that's supposed to be spent on taxpayers, on citizens, on the poor, for the most part, and you are saying we're going to give you less of that, or less efficiently give you that, because we're instead going to be essentially giving this premium to people who already own businesses, because of the color of their skin, you're very directly taking away services that should be going to the poor in this country, who are mostly black, and giving them to people who are already established in the economy in some way. It's just sort of so mad. And yet, I think the fact that, you know, Zondo's framing here reveals it to be so mad is exactly why there has been so little direct engagement with that point he makes. Michael, what do you make of this?
I absolutely agree. And just to underscore that point, our colleague Gabriel Krause has written a great deal about this particular piece of legislation and this process, not least drawing attention to what he calls the BEE era in South Africa and South African economy, which coincides with unemployment ramping up, and most particularly unemployment of black people. But just to underscore that very last point, there was a line from a piece he wrote a little earlier this year, where he says this: in a country where an estimated 1.7 million, that's a number to just let sink in, malnourished children are physically stunted. That's astonishing. But, you know, South Africa in 2024, 1.7 million malnourished children are physically stunted, he says. It's hardly a surprise that the BEE premium program for millionaires and billionaires was promulgated without any transparency about its cost. And this has been Gabriel's great bugbear over the past at least year, querying Treasury, asking Treasury, one email after the next, what is the sum that you are spending out of the 1.1 trillion rand you spend a year on public procurement for every government department, for every SOE, state-owned enterprise? What is the sum that you are paying as a premium to sustain black economic empowerment for the well-connected, the already rich, these large companies that manage to match the technical requirement? And he still hasn't had a satisfactory reply to that. Now, that is in contrast to the quite unambiguous statement in the Zondo Commission report, where Chief Justice Zondo wrote, ultimately, in the view of the Commission, the primary national interest, this is what interests everybody, the primary national interest is best served when the government derives the maximum value for money in the procurement process, and procurement officials should be so advised. So, you know, what Ramaphosa is now saying is simply failing to address this very, very simple, fundamental point spelled out there with in the plainest terms by Judge Zondo, and the background being this 1.1 trillion rand of public spending, taxpayers' money, that is being shaped and channeled by a policy that's clearly not meeting the value for money requirement. So, yeah, it's a shocking indictment, actually. He shouldn't be allowed to get away with claiming.
Indeed, indeed. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, this is signed into law, but it's going to be interesting to see how the politics of the GNU may or may not affect this. I think it's an important signpost on how effective the GNU is going to be. Sara, any final thoughts?
Just to say, and it's very much linked to this, is as soon as you're reserving awards of any governmental favor to a favored group in society, and we've had 30 years of it, so we know, you know, we know the limits of its reach. You inhibit the possibility of business growth generally, broadly, and therefore more likely to absorb people into the workforce. Mm. And we need nothing more at the moment than that. We'd be doing a hell of a favor if the government took its foot off and allowed those processes to happen more organically. Terrible word, but more organically.
Yeah. And there's another point, actually, which I think Gabriel has made and various other colleagues have made too, is that, in fact, removing BEE would benefit black-owned companies. You know, it because it benefits the entire economy, it's going to generate much more economic activity and dynamism and so on. Yeah. It's actually going to benefit the very, stands to reason, the very people that it's meant to benefit by, you know, taking that racial chokehold away.
Exactly. All right, let's move on to our next story. And this is kind of three separate things altogether about the internal state of the government of national unity and also the opposition to it we're seeing from the MK and EFF party. So the first one is some comments over the last couple of days with the ANC's Eastern Cape chairperson, Oscar Mabuyane, who has appealed to party members to respect the government of national unity, saying that it was a quote-unquote masterstroke of Ramaphosa for the country. Mabuyane was speaking during the ANC's provincial executive committee, Lekgotla, in the East London Convention Centre. He said, there is no DA that is going to swallow the ANC and the GNU. He said, but now after being in power for 30 years, we still have people saying that the DA is going to swallow the ANC. What we should be concerned about is that the DA got votes from our own constituencies. The fact that the ANC has been on a downward spiral, it is not just the DA, but small political parties who broke away from the ANC. The DA has a clear constituency which we are finding difficult to penetrate. They have been able to penetrate our constituency because we are vulnerable. He said that the GNU had brought stability and that it was, as I said, a masterstroke, and that ANC leaders must stop bickering over positions and being upset about the GNU. He said, comrades, we are left with about 2 years before the local government elections. We must change how we do things. It is unfortunate the ANC did not win the elections with an outright majority, but we must accept it as a new political reality. The middle class is not voting for the ANC. We need to find out why. The GNU will be with us for the next 5 years. Its existence has drastically changed the South African political landscape. So, to my mind, that's a pretty actually reasonable way to look at the ANC's position right now, and suggests that Mabuyane is on the side of those in the ANC who perhaps think that they maybe need to change course. At the same time, let's look across the aisle to the, you know, once former ANC comrades in MK and the EFF. Firstly, we've got a move by Jacob Zuma's MK to try and form a new competitor to COSATU, the belief being that the ANC tripartite alliance means that in order to take down the ANC, you have to take down all of its constituent parts, both the SACP and COSATU. So Zuma has been calling on people to join his a new union affiliated to MK, the Teachers and Education Workers Union of South Africa, to WUSA. And he says that, and his spokesperson said that there are many unions that are now wanting to be part or at least aligned to MK. Of course, COSATU has been in a rough position for a while now, so this is not, I'm sure this is not very welcome in COSATU's halls, because they've been in such a difficult position for a long time. And the last story I just want to talk about before I give it over to you guys is Julius Malema was speaking at the EFF's 11th birthday bash, celebrating the party's existence. And he says that critics of the EFF believe the organization would not survive if he were to step down as the party's president, and that the EFF is a cult. And he said, we're not a cult. Even Musi Maimane's Build One South Africa is far less democratic than the EFF. Musi Maimane's got his name in the name of the organization, said Malema. But Musi Maimane is not called a cult. Malema has got no EFF Malema, but he's got a cult. Why? Because they want to destroy the person of Malema. Malema believes that a wealthy elite have joined forces to exploit their economic influence to smear the EFF's standing. I would somewhat rudely say that you can't really call an organization a cult if it's only got two members in parliament. It's a little bit, it's not very intimidating. I think this is very much a case of the lady doth protest too much. And I think everybody knows that who has any sort of passing familiarity with the EFF. I mean, just go on social media, go on Twitter and say something nasty about Malema, and you will very much see the cult in action in a way that even other political parties, I think, struggle to match from their most dedicated partisans. But that being said, what do you make of this? Firstly, what do you make of the MK party's attempts to create a rival to COSATU?
Well, you know, we're talking about the politics of the past, and you know, it's often been said that your past should inform your future, but not dictate it. And what MK is showing, particularly in the person of Jacob Zuma, is that he really all he wants is the copy and paste ANC. If it doesn't look like and sound like the ANC, it is not the ANC, and he wants the ANC. Because the whole idea of going into alliances with trade unions, frankly, you know, it's may not be particularly good business, given the fact that the trade union movement broadly, up COSATU and beyond, its growth, its membership, and its income depends on a good economic environment. And we haven't had a good economic environment for a long time. And the result has been a COSATU that is largely, not entirely, but largely representative of the public sector. That's not a good mechanism for growth in the future. So it's an old idea. I think it's obviously intended to be populist and, you know, rah-rah, but A, it's an old idea, and B, you know, COSATU has gone through having influence. That influence resulted in Zuma's ascension to power. COSATU regretted that in the long run, for all the reasons we've regretted it in the long run. And also there's the added thing where, for all its ills, the ANC has been a broad church. Whether that's always an advantage or not is another question. The problem is that MK is a Zulu nationalist entity, and your union members are not tribally singular. Trade unions come from wherever they, or rather trade union members come from wherever they come from, and it's will cross the broad range of tribal affiliation or non-affiliation as the country can offer. So I'm not sure that I agree with the analysts who say this is, you know, sort of canny move, that's how you get the working class on board. Let's put it this way. If MK really wanted to do something, the working class they would get on board is the working class that isn't working.
No, that's exactly right. Michael, what do you make of Eastern Cape chairperson's comments on the GNU, and to ask the question why the middle class is not voting for the ANC? I mean, it's a good question to ask, although I suspect to an honest observer, the answer is fairly clear.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I mean, I think the first observation to be made is this is surely a healthy sign that here's somebody from a ruling party who is acknowledging how democracy works. They've been punished at the polls, and he's confronting some hard truths here about where the constituency is, how effective the ANC is in one or another constituency. I was just thinking, as you were, sorry, I was talking about the working class. I mean, the one thing about the working class, probably the truest thing you can say about it, is that it doesn't want to be the working class anymore. It wants to be the middle class. So this is a very healthy thing. It's perfectly modern development right across the world over the past 200 years, and it's as true here as anywhere else. And we see it in the constant movement of people to the cities, to urban environments. This is how we've all moved around the world. It's a very healthy kind of natural thing. And if society satisfies that desire for mobility, both physically and economically, then you have a success. You have a successful society. And it's quite interesting thinking about unions. I mean, unions, I think, are a very important part of a free society, but they've also got to be responsive to where people are working and how people are working. And it's been, you know, Sarah's quite right, this nostalgia for a kind of capitalist, the capital's satanic mills, you know, it's really it's a kind of Victorian idea, the idea of industrial workers who are, you know, a hammer in one hand and a bolt cutter in the other, whatever it might be. It's just out of sync. It's anachronistic in modern South Africa. We don't have a massive industrial base. And people don't want to work in factories. You know, they want better jobs and they want city life and they want, and if unions are not associated or connected to that. So I think in that sense, what the ANC's, I forget his name now for a moment, fellow in the Eastern Cape, Mabiani is saying is very interesting. And a kind of acknowledgement, perhaps, that within the ruling party there are these people who are looking at the hard facts. They've been around for a long time, but history doesn't preordain them to be around forever. And they need to do things to survive. So this is a very healthy thing. Whereas you look at the others, MK and Malema, it's very striking. We were talking before the show, the image used in the EWN story about the somewhat peculiar 11th birthday celebration, but the image used of Malema is of him with a white shirt and a red tie, looking almost sort of executive. Which is quite a far cry from his, from, you know, the quite studied image that they tried to present of being very workerist and very sort of overally and so on. No hard hat and overall in sight here. But I suppose the other thing to say there is that, you know, if you deny that you're a cult, you're probably almost certainly a cult. I think that must be a truism of these things. But yeah. But certainly, I mean, it's quite interesting that that there are, you know, the ANC people in the ANC, influential people who are acknowledging the result of the fate that history has delivered, and for exactly the right reasons. You know.
Sara, any final thoughts?
Just to say, with regard to Julius, is the if you were a man who's confident and the direction of the party and the policies they want to pursue were bearing fruit well for the party, you wouldn't see such a defensive response to a comment that otherwise someone in Julius's position should ignore. We did joke about the fact that, you know, maybe you limit your longevity as a party is limited by the number of the fact that you celebrate every birthday you have, rather than just the milestone birthdays. But I think this is a sign, as is his very personal attack on Ramaphosa in Parliament, his racial attacks, sort of being on the scene metaphorically speaking in the press on these allegations of racism at schools very quickly. I think that's a sign of a party that is now coming up from behind. It's sort of radical chic, you know, red overall wearing, disruptive. It's tired, it's over, it's been superseded by MK, and the whole result of the election is really requires a reinvention. And this is a man who sort of, who strikes one as sort of flailing at reinventing, and partly because it is a personality cult party.
Yeah, and you know, you cannot run an organization in the long run if it is too much based around one person. Inevitably, that person will clash with new talent, and you will get stuck into patterns and not be able to refresh your ranks. And we've seen that with recently with the EFF, where some of their more kind of charismatic upcoming young people in the party, people who are skilled at organizing, people who are skilled at giving speeches and debates. You know, I'm not saying that any of these people align even vaguely with my politics, but they were people with undeniable skill, have been bullied out of the party, humiliated out of it, fired, chucked out of parliament, fired for not bringing enough buses to you know, the EFF's bash or whatever. It's completely damaging to the party's organizational structure. And I think MK in many ways has the same problem. Yeah. Their advantage, I think, is that they do at least have someone like Hlophe, who, even though I don't think he's, you know, a great political force in the country, is, I would say, a little bit more talented than many of the second-in-commands in the EFF, who I don't think are up to much. Anyway, let's talk about our last story quickly. And this is about the census. So South Africa was meant to have a census in, 2021 or 2020. COVID kind of messed it up, made it delayed. There were all sorts of problems with it, mismanagement problems, difficulty getting data in, lots of issues. And as a result, when the census came out in 2022, there has been quite a lot of questions raised about the quality of the data. By the census's own admission, there was an undercount of about 30%. They believe specifically of minority South Africans. And so they, when there's an undercount, they have to adjust the data to kind of make up for that undercount. And the more adjusting you do, the less accurate it is. Now, I'm not a statistician, but I believe that you're supposed to have sort of a below 10% undercount or overcount. We had a 30% undercount, which seems not great, Bob, as they say. And this is now starting to have actual effects on governance, because the census is used as the basis for a number of things. For example, which municipalities get certain amounts of money from national government, how to plan infrastructure, all sorts of things like that. It's used from the national to the municipal level, and of course also the provincial level, to work out how resources should be spent in government. So currently the city of Joburg is fighting with the census, saying that they are going to ignore the census data because they don't believe it to be correct. The census data says that Joburg grew only about 8.3% since 2011, whereas Cape Town has grown by 27.6% in the same time, which means that the two cities are now almost equivalent in size, according to the census. The city of Joburg rejects this very vehemently, saying that they've grown a lot more and a lot of this hasn't been captured. There have been some independent statisticians who have also criticized the census. It's not just people with financial incentive to do so. So, I don't know. I do get the feeling that the census was a bit of a mess up, to be quite honest. Michael, what do you think?
It certainly seems so. I mean, a number of people have engaged with this. It's very telling if you look at the News24 story quoting Treasury. The Treasury says it is still actively engaged in consultation, I love that phrasing, with Stats SA to, quote, determine the most appropriate and responsible approach, also a lovely phrase, the most appropriate and responsible approach to using Census 2022 data. So, I mean, this clearly indicates that there's very deep and widespread disquiet about whether the information is entirely reliable. The story also says the budget framework tabled in February indicated that the Treasury decided not to use Census 2022 data because it had not had enough time to engage with it. Well, you know, if you need to engage with figures for a long time before you can use them, that would suggest there's a bit of a problem. And I can't remember who it was now. One of our colleagues, was it Ivo Fechter maybe, who wrote at some length about former Stats SA officials having warned about the steady reduction in funding, curtailing the organization's ability to do the number crunching and the gathering and the research and so on. And Stats SA is always, I mean, it always has been really an excellent source of information. We've certainly relied on their data for our annual surveys and for all of our research. Just about, you know, so much of it rests on data from Stats SA. So, you know, it's a vital source. and resource for organizations like ours, for government departments, for the private sector. And the minute it becomes doubtful, the minute the credibility is called into question, it then becomes hugely, hugely problematic. So, yeah, it would be a great shame if there is this problem, and one only hopes that somebody is going to vote more funding to this organization and make sure that it gets back on its feet. We need to know if we're doing well or not doing well. We need to know if you know policies are failing. The only way to do that really is to count. You know, we count how many people are poor, we count how many people have got houses, and how many people there are in the country. So yeah.
Yeah, and there's, you know, a lot of the research we've done that's included in our sort of annual survey comes from StatsSA, and some of it comes from the census as well. So there's a whole range of things to do with politics, everything from kind of research on sociology to planning to all these sort of stuff, finance, that depends on the accuracy of the census. And it unfortunately seems as though like the census has fallen victim to what so many of our government institutions have fallen into, which is a kind of mismanagement and decay. Sara, any final thoughts?
Just to say, it's probably the one element of one of the few elements of government that's probably less about mismanagement and decay and just more about the withdrawal of resources. With the former government not being entirely understanding of how crucially necessary this information is. I mean, as it is with a census, with any statistics, but certainly with a census, and one that has a 30% undercount, that information becomes unreliable very quickly. And, you know, you compare Joburg and Cape Town, but the question is, where in what classes have the two cities grown or not grown? And is it easier if you're looking at counting a middle-class migration to Cape Town as being a significant part versus people coming into a city like Joburg to survive? And you need good figures for your population, but you also need to be able to project into the future with some level of reliability. Otherwise, you're always going to be under-budgeted, and that, I think, is the real risk.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Wrap. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.